come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know, catapult to propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
The situation for Christians in the Middle East has been described as a 10-year descent into hell. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. Our guest is a military analyst, a strategist for the Pentagon. He's served as, active-duty military, retired lieutenant colonel in the Army. He's also served for many years as an analyst on military and foreign affairs issue, and most of the cable news networks, especially Fox News. And he is the author of a new book just out from Defender Publishing. Should be in stores in just a couple of weeks. Never Submit, Will the Extermination of Christians Get Worse Before It Gets Better? It's our honor to welcome Lieutenant Colonel Bob McGinnis to the program.
Well, thank you, Derek.
This is a topic that is very timely. We're seeing stories in the news, videos that are showing up on YouTube. It's horrific what has been happening there. But numerically, statistically, the numbers don't lie. 1.5 million Christians or thereabouts in Iraq in 2003. Today, perhaps as few as 200,000. What is happening to Christians in the Middle East, and how have American policies, foreign policies, affected their situation?
Well, there's actually a genocide of Christians in the Middle East, and you can thank not only the Islamic governments there, but more so the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. They are killing Christians by the hundreds. They are running the few that they don't kill out of the region, as you've indicated with Iraq, but you know, they can't go to places like Saudi Arabia because they're unwelcome there. They can't go to Turkey because the president and the Islamic government of Turkey doesn't allow them to go there. So where do they end up? In camps, perhaps in Lebanon, or you know, they're pushed into the sea. We've seen, you know, boatloads of people that have, you know, tried to get to the southern part of Europe across the Mediterranean. In fact, the Mediterranean's becoming almost an Islamic, you know, lake of sorts. Very distressing situation. It's not getting any better. And of course, when you look at, as I do in Never Submit, the 8 classic conditions of genocide, every one of them is in play across the Middle East today. And I don't see any reason to believe it's going to improve anytime soon.
Mm. The situation on the Mediterranean is getting dire. Just this morning was looking at news headlines over the last couple of years, and it seems like every month there's another tragedy where a boat capsizes and sinks. You know, we see this occasionally or saw it in years past with the Cuban refugees trying to make it to Florida. But, was it this April or the previous April, just recently, where a boat capsized, 900 people trying to get from North Africa across to Italy, Sicily, were killed. There have even been some indications, some accusations thrown about that the navies of certain nations, Greece and Italy in particular, are actually starting to sink the boats that are coming over because there are so many people trying to get away from these horrific conditions that it's more that, especially in Greece and Italy, whose economies are not too stable anyway, they can't absorb that many people. What are we doing in the West to facilitate this? Is the United States, are we offering any assistance at all to these people?
Yeah. When you were saying that, Derek, it reminded me of what happened during World War II against the Jews. Mm. You know, there were Jews that tried desperately to flee Adolf Hitler. And we turned a blind eye. The Roosevelt administration turned a blind eye. They made it so difficult to immigrate to the United States. We're seeing the same thing happen. The Obama administration favors Muslims immigrating from the Middle East, but not Christians. Mm-hmm. And they've they've allowed the United Nations, who was not a very fair player, to vet all of these people. You know, just the other day, we heard about number was 70 Syrians that were, you know, stocked into the back of a semi-truck and found, you know, their rotting corpses was opened east of Vienna. They had apparently been smuggled up through the Bosphorus into the Balkans and then finally into Austria. People coming across from northern Africa, from Libya mostly, they're fleeing, mostly Christians, because they have no hope. There's no hope in places like Syria. There's no hope in even in Egypt, where there's a large Coptic population. It used to be 8 million, but it's rapidly declining. Mm-hmm. The Islamists are taking over the Sinai. They're taking over downtown Cairo. So across the entire region, even as far as east of the Iranians that are terribly intolerant of especially evangelicals, there is oppression, and it's getting worse.
What role is the Islamic State playing in all of this? I mean, clearly they've been very dramatic in demonstrating how they deal with their enemies. We've seen images of the Jordanian fighter pilot burned alive in a cage. Well, you mentioned Coptic Christians, those, in fact, who were in Libya to try to get to a vessel to get across to Europe, Coptic Christians executed on the shores of the Mediterranean by the Islamic State in Libya. Is this a policy of genocide that they're carrying out?
Well, they're just doing what the 7th century prophet Muhammad would do. You know, I recall one of the early accounts and one of the hadiths, which is the sayings of Prophet Muhammad, is that he sat there at Medina next to his 12-year-old wife, and he ordered the execution, the beheading of 600 Jews.
Hmm.
You know, what ISIS is doing today is playing out they're emulating their 7th century prophet. And they're doing exactly what the Quran, the Sirah, and the Hadith are told the 7th century people to do. And you know, that's to stone, that's to crucify, that's to behead, that's to destroy the crops of anyone that is considered an infidel, anyone that's an unbeliever. And you're given three choices. Usually the last is rejected. You can either die, or you can convert to Islam, or you can pay a tax. Well, they're not allowing them to pay taxes anymore by virtue of what the caliph, Baghdadi, has said. So, you know, Christians just have what I would consider, from their perspective, these are the end times.
Hmm. They've been very upfront in telling us what they're trying to do. They even named their magazine Dabiq, which is the city that they believe, from that hadith you mentioned, the site of the final cataclysmic battle against the forces of Rome, the Christian military forces that will result in the miraculous return of Jesus. Not Jesus, but their
Jesus.
Yeah, their Jesus. So they've been very clear in stating what their goals are and how they want to achieve those goals. And yet our government has said they're upset because they don't have enough jobs.
Yeah.
Why is there such a disconnect? And a military initiative to try to determine why this is so popular. Last December, General Nagata led this initiative. And I give him credit for thinking outside the box. I do. But when I read in the article from the New York Times that one of the tasks that was presented to some of the experts they brought in was to analyze the branding strategies of ISIS to find out what makes it so popular, I have to scratch my head. It's like it's the branding strategies right there. You know, kill Christians, take over the world. Why is there such a disconnect between what they're telling us and what our leaders are hearing?
Well, it starts at the very top. The President of the United States has said this is the JV team. He has said that this is un-Islamic. He says that they have hijacked Islam, that they aren't representing the truth. Well, they are. They are living out the 7th century prophet's vision for what a good Muslim would do. And it's not pretty. The U.S. military takes orders. The U.S. military has been given appointees by President Obama that oversee each of the parts of the Pentagon staff, the same thing with the State Department, so forth. These are ideologues in many cases, and they're taking orders from the National Security Council, which is controlled directly by the president. So if they're going to ignore what the intelligence says, what the ideology says, then the military, you know, we have a military that takes orders, and it just doesn't go out on its own and do what's necessary to kill the enemy.
That, you know, I've never been privileged to serve, but I can only imagine how frustrating that must be.
Well, it is frustrating when you see, you know, for guys that I sit around in the Pentagon that have served in Iraq 4 or 5 times. That's a big part of their life.
Mm-hmm.
And they won Iraq back to stability, saved a lot of lives. But when we left in December of 11 by choice, based on the status of forces agreement that the Obama administration could have negotiated and left more forces, the Iraqi security forces fell apart. The Shia took over. The government of Iraq chased out most of the Sunnis. So the idea of diversity, the idea of inclusion went out the window. And so today Iraq is divided against. You have Anbar province is Sunni. You have everything. Baghdad south is Shia. Then you have the Kurds that are fat, dumb, and happy up in the northeast because, you know, they really think that they're going to be an independent country in the future, which is probably true. Iraq's not going to be put back together again. And yet our forces, the people that, you know, gave up their lives, the people that were wounded, the people that gave up time of their life, see this and say, it didn't need to happen. ISIS was a creation that started with the Al-Qaeda of Iraq back in the early 2000s, and then it morphed into the Islamic State of Iraq under Abu Dakar al-Baghdadi. And then in 2010, it really became something like it is today. So we have seen this evolution. We could have stopped it long ago. We didn't stop it. And it was all because apparently the president has an agenda here. You know, Franklin Graham, when I interviewed him for this book, said that, you know, Mr. Obama had a Muslim father, that his first major speech in the Middle East was in Cairo in June of 2009, and he didn't even consult with the Israelis. You know, it was a spoken policy between us and the Israelis that you always, on a major policy speech impacting their security, would let them have, you know, heads up. Mm-hmm. We didn't do that. He went in there, did not tell the Israelis what he's going to say, and it had major implications for them.
Sure.
So the Obama presidency, Mr. Obama himself and his lackeys, have decimated decades and decades of good policy in some cases in the Middle East and cost us thousands of American lives, trillions of dollars, and has going to leave a legacy that it was going to take decades, if it ever can be reversed.
Just a rabbit trail for a moment, because I think this is, I find this aspect of the whole puzzle really interesting and potentially really important, and that is the role of the Turkish government and the Kurds. The Turks recently agreed to allow us to use the Incirlik Air Base to launch airstrikes against the Islamic State, and as part of this deal, they were also going to launch airstrikes against the Islamic State. But they've also taken that air war to the Kurds in Iraq because they don't want the Kurds getting uppity and deciding that they're going to be independent. The Kurds in Iraq basically are kind of independent right now, but the territory that's majority Kurd includes a big chunk of southeast Turkey, also northwest Iran. So if there was an independent Kurdistan, the Turks would be impacted. And, you know, President Erdogan doesn't want that to happen. The Kurds really have been the only effective fighting force to stand up to the Islamic State over the last year since the caliphate was announced. So here we are in a situation where, you know, unlike the old saying, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, we've got the friend of my friend is his enemy. And I'm struggling to make any sense of this.
Yeah, well, we've seen the Peshmerga, which is the fighting force of the Iraqi Kurds. That's been about the only effective fighting force. And of course, you know, it's interesting, the Obama administration has stopped us from trying to deliver weapons to them. They say all the weapons must go through Baghdad.
I was going to ask you about that.
Well, the pipeline, by the time it gets to Erbil, Kurdistan, is empty. All the weapons are drained by Iraqi security forces down south. Mm. It doesn't get up there. So they're working with old weapons, little ammunition, much less. You know, even though the 2015 National Defense Authorization Act allowed those weapons to go to the Kurds, allowed it to even go to the Christian militia in the Nineveh plain, none of it gets up there. And it's by design by the Shia. They hate the Kurds. They hate the Sunnis. And this partisan bickering will continue until they're all dead in the north, unless we do something. And we've just refused to resupply them. You know, the Kurds, of course, were incredibly effective against ISIS in Kobani, which is just south of the Turkish border.
Right.
But here recently, you know, this is really a farce because the president, Erdogan, has decided that after problems with the Kurds, they use the, you know, kind of the pretense of helping the United States against ISIS by allowing us to use Incirlik, which they weren't allowing us to launch fighters from before, but now they will. But it gave them the opportunity to fly jet aircraft into northern Iraq to bomb Kurdish facilities, the PKK, which is a problem. They mm-hmm. consider it a terrorist organization. So do we, technically.
Yeah, they're listed by the State Department as officially on the terror list of terror organizations.
But they're the only people that have been effective at fighting ISIS.
Right.
And so, it is such a messed up situation, and yet the Obama administration is part and parcel to, you know, making this muddier all the time.
Hmm. So taking this back to our borders, how serious is the Islamic threat to the United States?
Well, you have a choice. You can either fight them over there or fight them here.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't fight them over there and they continue to metastasize as they have, you know, they started off a couple of years ago, you know, last summer of June of 2014, and they took, of course, they took Mosul. Before there, 2010, you know, Baghdadi said, you know, we're going to establish a caliphate. But then you go forward, you know, they're in Libya, mm-hmm. They're threatening Tunisia, they're all over the Sinai, they have friends in Yemen, they're blowing up bombs in Saudi Arabia, of course, Iraq, everything north of Baghdad and even south of Baghdad, to a certain extent, has ISIS. They dominate Anbar province, they're mm-hmm. threatening the Kurds. They're in Afghanistan. They have a franchise there. Central Asia has a franchise. There are fighters that are in the Caucasus of Russia, which is north of Georgia.
Armenia, Georgia, South Ossetia, Abkhazia.
Yep. In between the Caspian Sea and the Black Sea, you know, that landmass where we had the Olympics.
Yes. And there's some saber rattling going on right now between Armenia and Azerbaijan. They're threatening war.
Well, they've done that for decades. They hate each other.
Yeah.
So you have enough animosity without adding the Islamic problem.
Right.
You know, keep in mind the Boston bombers, the Marathon bombers, they came from the Caucasus,
right.
Dagestan, and the mom's still over there. You know, they hate us too. So you've got enough of these people around that region that hate us. Now, if you're not going to do something about it, and Obama said he was going to destroy them, well, you know, our strategy has been to train Syrian rebels to fight us, well, or to fight ISIS. Sorry, we spent a lot of money. They're not doing too well. They were killed by the al-Nusra, mm-hmm. Al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria. The bombing, most of the jets come back with their payloads already. They can't drop the bombs in the middle of the towns because we don't have spotters on the ground. And you don't want to kill innocent people because that, understandably, that's going to cause problems. And then, of course, the Iraqi security forces, you know, we've been spending money on them, training them, but they have yet to retake Ramadi, which they, you know, lost in April, much less Mosul and Fallujah. They lost in January of 14. Mm-hmm. You know, they haven't done any good, and they're corrupt. So there really isn't an Iraqi security force anymore that's reliable. So you look at the strategy. We have a failed strategy. Now, if you want to change the strategy and it's going to be costly, the longer you wait, it becomes more costly.
Yeah. It's kind of like what's going on with the economic situation right now. We keep, you know, the stock market bubble inflated, the Chinese government doing it with their stock exchange right now. It just means the ultimate collapse that much more difficult, that much more painful.
And, you know, Derek, it's not just ISIS. I am concerned about Iran. You know, here you have ISIS, which is as far radical as the Sunnis can become. And you have the Islamic State of Iran, mm-hmm. which is about as far as the Shia can go. And they're getting a nuclear weapon eventually. I don't think there's any question. And, of course, the Saudis, they already have ballistic missiles, and they have a backdoor deal, we hear in the press, with the Pakistanis, also – Sunni, and they've been giving them billions of dollars over the years, and we've noticed here recently some new nuclear work in Pakistan. So, you know, the Saudis understand that we've abandoned them in mm-hmm. terms of protecting them against Iran. Iran will proceed to get a weapon at some future point, and of course the Russians are rushing in, the Chinese are rushing in, the Europeans are slap happy because they're going to get all this money from all the new deals because the Iranians are sitting on 50 million barrels of oil and they need business. So you've got all this turbulence going on.
Yeah.
I don't see how in the world this is going to turn good. Now, you know, the question is, of course, is this the end times? Are we building up to Gog and Magog, and are we building up to, you know, an apocalypse is going to have a final battle, Armageddon? I don't know. But, you know, this scenario, what's really happening certainly is painting a pretty bleak picture.
Yeah, yeah. And I think the difference between the way Christians look at this and the way the radical Mahdists, the radical Sunnis especially, are looking at this, there's a fundamental difference. You know, I look forward to the day when Christ returns.
Right.
But knowing that there are a lot of people out there who haven't accepted him yet, I'm not really in a hurry for that to happen. I mean, it would be great for him to, you know, fix the world. But there are a lot of people out there who aren't yet saved who might have an opportunity to hear and accept the gospel, accept Jesus Christ as Lord in the intervening time. The radical Sunnis, the Mahdists, they think they're going to, you know, tripwire, mm-hmm. hotwire the apocalypse by forcing that battle at Dabiq.
Right.
Now, Iran, and I know that there's some discussion about this. I, and again, you know, granted that I'm not an expert on geopolitics in that part of the world, but it seems to me that the Ayatollahs are in some respects similar to the Sanhedrin of Jesus' day, the religious leaders who control pretty much all of Iranian society, and they've got some pretty cushy jobs that they would lose if the Mahdi suddenly showed up. So they may not be as eager to see the Mahdi and the end times come on as the Sunnis of the Islamic State. But, you know, be that as it may, here at home, we've got an issue where we had, for example, the Chattanooga shooter who killed some of our servicemen there at the recruiting station and at the naval base. We go back even a little further to the Fort Hood and Major Hassan at Fort Hood. We've had incidents here inside the United States, and those incidents might even occur and continue if we do something in the Middle East to protect what's left of the Christian communities there. Talk about that and how we in the United States might address the issue from radical Islam and how that relates to the title of your book, Never Submit.
Well, of course, Never Submit. We don't, you know, give in, submit to Islam, which is submission. Yeah, I outline Never Submit campaign. I actually teach how to do campaign plans. And so in the book, I teach or I outline a campaign plan to, you know, address the very mm-hmm. issues that we've been talking
now,
about.
Do you use the word campaign like a military campaign or as opposed to a political campaign?
No, it's a campaign plan. It's a military campaign plan.
And that's
how I think. So, you know, you start off, you need leaders, you know. We really need Christian leaders in this world today. We need Bonhoeffers. We need Martin Luther Kings. We need William Wilberforce. It's those types of folks that have a vision, understand where we are and where we're going. Then we need to have the international community engaged. You know, that when we look across this as a campaign, we have to understand the commander's intent. How do we get the commander's intent? We pray. God has made it very clear what he wants us to do as people, as Christians, and sharing the gospel with our fellow human beings, the Muslims, that mm-hmm. need Christ. Mm-hmm. We have to understand the enemy, and we've talked about understanding ISIS. We've talked about understanding the Islamic governments and how oppressive they are to Christians. You have to provide logistics. You know, we have to give hope to the Christians, a few Christians left there. They need food. They need shelter. They need protection.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have to provide security, you know, whether it's creating enclaves for Christians that are going to be fearful that ISIS is going to raid and kill all their men and rob their women and make them sex slaves, as they often do.
Mm-hmm.
We have to use the information that we have, what we call information operations across the world, and especially in our own country, to keep our young people from being radically, you know, inclined to join ISIS, and we've had hundreds of them that have tried to, some of which have been successful. You know, then we have to get politically active. We have to put pressure on not only the political, the presidential campaign candidates, but also in Congress. You know, these people have to be held accountable. You know, we have Christians that are dying. We have a country that is, you know, is getting threatened all the time. You know, there are right things to do. And I outline those there. And then also, you know, what we ought to do as individuals, as churches, and as communities. I outline, we've got an agenda by, believe it or not, the Saudi Arabian government to recruit proselytize in all our prisons. And we welcome them in there. Mm-hmm. They're imams. They're paid for by the Saudi government. There's a part of the embassy in Saudi Arabian embassy in Washington that, you know, is kind of the conduit for all the material that goes into our prison systems that promotes Salafism, the most radical of Islamic, Sunni Islamic beliefs. And so we should not be surprised when 99% of converts, Islamic converts in the prison systems, believe it or not, end up being African Americans. I do an analysis in here. And, you know, it takes advantage of psychological vulnerabilities. And, you know, and that's exactly how they go after, you know, people that are down and out. Yeah. And prison is a place. And then we talked about schools. We talk about Sharia law being enforced, replacing our constitution, public, you know, schools, and a host of other things. You know, there's a complete agenda here.
There's something that I know Sharon was talking to me about earlier, and we didn't get to ask this on Skywatch TV, but you talk about the agenda in our schools and what our children are being taught in the public school system about the Islamic faith. How do we address that as parents, as grandparents?
Well, curriculum committees in every county of the United States, in every state, they look at the curriculum. Who do you think writes curriculum for about the Middle East? It typically is, you know, funded by the Saudis. And how do you think it's biased? It's biased against, you know, they make us out to be crusaders. You know, I have a whole section in here on what's the truth about the Crusades. It's been distorted. And then, of course, they paint the Prophet Muhammad as a peace-loving person. You know, he was chopping heads, you know, right after he got started. You know, and he really feeds the whole violent thing. You know, we've got to address that at the local school boards. We have to address it at the state education commissions. And if you don't, then our kids are going to get really misguided information. They're already bigoted against Christian teaching and talking about the Bible and Christ in our secular schools. But now they're just in the opposite direction on Islam.
Hmm. I want to circle back around to Europe. You've got personal experience with the situation there. You've spent time there. You've got family members who live in Germany, and Germany in particular, but nations all across the EU are struggling with trying to assimilate Muslim populations. What is the situation there, and what lessons can we take from Europe?
Well, there have been a number of books written on the very issue of what I've seen personally. You know, it's like the dog, the Dalmatian dog, they have spots all over. Mm-hmm. Well, if you thought of the map of Western Europe as a Dalmatian, you would see these spots all over where, you know, there are ghettos of sorts of where Muslims have occupied, and they push out all vestiges of culture, all language. They've only allowed inside here the Sharia law, their own country that they came from, the language and culture and so forth. And anyone that even comes close to them, they persecute. You know, there have been all sorts of accounts in which, you know, Muslim youth have taken over trains, say in Germany, and they've intimidated non-Muslim riders. Look at what's happened in, certainly in Denmark and Sweden. Mm-hmm. You know, you've seen the terrible tragedies on the train there in France, and certainly, the riots in Paris. Those were all Muslim youth.
The attack on the satirical periodical
Charlie Hebdo.
Right.
You know, that was Islamist. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a large population in France, and I don't know if it's 20% or so of Islamics, and they refuse to really integrate within those cultures. They don't want the language. They don't want the culture. They want to bring their own. And then, of course, they have a very fertile population, mm-hmm. and they grow. And this is what I call civilizational jihad. Basically, you know, and this is something that the Muslim Brotherhood, which is the largest really political Muslim organization around the world. I think there are 85 or so nations which have formalized Muslim Brotherhood to include this country. And they go in and they say, this is how we're going to do it. We're going to have a seed and we're going to grow as fast as we can. We're going to take over the local government. We're going to impose Sharia law like they have in family matters in certain parts of Dallas, Texas, and some other places, Dearborn, Michigan, and so forth. And then eventually we'll take over, you know, the entire region or the state. Mm-hmm. So they have a very clear agenda.
Now, how does that work with the legal, basically imposing Sharia law in civil matters? There's certainly not the United States courts or local court systems that are imposing or drawing on Sharia law.
Well, certainly in the Dallas situation, we have the recognition of a family Sharia law. Well, and they've basically surrendered themselves voluntarily to abide by that Sharia court's decisions. Well, the way in which the law is written in Texas, if the lower court, in this case the Sharia court, makes a decision, then it's binding on the civil court at the higher level, at the whatever the upper layers are. That's how they've done it in England too.
Wow.
And you know, you have situations where they've gone beyond the family law. They've gone into civil law and in some cases into criminal law because Sharia talks about every aspect of life. And if you allow it to morph like that, then it really gets out of control. And that's what could happen in this country. And it would usurp constitutional law, which is what we have in certainly in the 14th Amendment.
Wow. You wouldn't have expected to hear about that happening in Texas.
No, you wouldn't.
I've got a hunch that some of the fellows that I know around here, in the Ozarks wouldn't be too keen on that either. But it's happening. Why? I mean, how is this happening? What have we done wrong that we've allowed this much of a foothold in the United States?
Well, we're too tolerant. We're too tolerant of people who want to impose their outside agenda on us. You know, if they want Sharia law, then go back to the country they came from. You know, I asked Franklin Graham that question. He said, yeah, you know, they're welcome to have the Sharia law, but take it over there. You know, here we have a constitutional republic, mm-hmm. and that constitutional republic, you know, doesn't recognize another source of law. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, you know, this has kind of crept in the back door, much like it goes into our schools and our prisons, and it goes into our local law, and then it contaminates to the 3,000 or so mosques we have in this country. You know, if you went and listened to some of these radical, you know, imams, you know, they may be speaking in Arabic, but they're speaking blasphemy about, you know, our country. They're trying to undercut the legitimacy and the direction of our country. They're calling for jihad. And in a lot of cases, that jihad is not nonviolent.
Mm. What is the takeaway, the thing that you hope people who read your new book, Never Submit, leave with and stick with? What point do you hope sticks with somebody who picks up and reads a book?
Well, everyone needs to take personal responsibility. It starts in the home, educating our children on, you know, what they believe in the Bible, but also what they believe in terms of, you know, the country and our civil rights and what should be tolerated. You know, they need to be politically active. They need to tell their congressmen. They need to question the presidential candidates. We need leadership at the top that, you know, keeps the country in the direction where our founders had in mind. You know, it's supposed to be a republic, and it's not supposed to be abiding to Sharia law and the like. Our brothers and sisters are being killed in masses. They're being run out. This administration is doing very little to stop it. They could do much more. And our so-called allies are doing even less. You know, we're cozy. You see our president bowing to the Saudi Arabian mm-hmm. president yeah. or king. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not becoming of a constitutional republic, much less the president of the United States. We need to recognize our foreign policy does matter. It saves lives if it's done right, and it costs lives when it's done wrong. And this president, I think, has, you know, violated the trust the American people have put in him. And as a result, we've lost a lot of innocent people.
Mm. The book is Never Submit, Will the Extermination of Christians Get Worse Before It Gets Better? Lieutenant Colonel Robert McGinnis, advisor to the Pentagon and an analyst that you will see periodically on cable network news. And as the book rolls out here in the next few weeks, you'll probably be hearing him on a number of talk programs and seeing him as a guest on a number of other programs on cable news as well. Look forward to getting our copy when the pallet rolls in from the printer here. And we appreciate you taking so much of your time today to talk to us. Bob, thank you very much. It's been an honor.
Thank you, Derek.
You'll find a link in the show notes at vftb.net to where you can get a copy of Never Submit by Colonel Bob McGinnis. It should be out in just a couple of weeks toward the end of September, available from Defender Publishing. Kind of depressing when you read it. Not that his style is depressing, but it's, I think, demoralizing as an American looking at the situation in the Middle East and recognizing that according to our own intelligence agencies, the Defense Intelligence Agency, according to documents that were obtained by Judicial Watch, which is the government watchdog group, filed a Freedom of Information Act request and found that the Defense Intelligence Agency, the DIA, 2 years ago was warning the government, the administration, not to support al-Qaeda in Iraq. That was one of the so-called moderate rebel groups that we were arming to take down Bashar Assad in Syria. The DIA said, if we do this, we're going to create an Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. They said so in so many words. The government decided apparently that it was so important that we get rid of Bashar Assad that we went ahead anyway. And now we have, guess what? An Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. Now, I've done a fair bit of comment and reporting on this on Skywatch TV, and some of the comments that I've received back have been rather angry of people who seem upset that I've not focused enough time on who's responsible for creating the Islamic State, as though somehow it is a sock puppet of American intelligence. I agree that we in the West are responsible for funding and arming this group. We also, going all the way back to the George W. Bush years, made a serious mistake when, after the fall of Saddam Hussein, we abolished the Ba'ath Party, that's B-A-A-T-H, that was his political party, and said that anyone who was a member of that party, anyone who was a member of the Iraqi military at the time that we invaded in 2003, was barred from government service, barred from holding a job of any position of authority in Iraq. So what did these guys do? These guys have become the core leadership of the Islamic State. Guys with fairly extensive military experience. I mean, not the kind of military experience that our American-trained soldiers receive, but still, guys who were career military, who were basically kicked out and said, you can no longer serve in the new Iraqi military. Now, these are the Sunnis who, remember, in Iraq comprise a minority of the population. We turned the country upside down and basically said, okay, the majority Shia who were more or less oppressed or at least restrained under the Saddam Hussein regime were now given the keys to the country, and they wanted payback. Nouri al-Maliki, the former prime minister of Iraq, was widely considered in the Sunni communities, as I understand it, as a guy who was using his authority and the backing of the United States of America to put the screws to the Sunnis in Iraq, who, again, are a minority. Well, again, many of the officers, the officer corps of the Iraqi military that we had just disbanded, decided to get together for the protection of their communities. Can you blame them for that? No. Now, they have taken it to an extreme where under the direction of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, and of course Abu Bakr is a name that's deliberately chosen. Abu Bakr was the father-in-law of Muhammad, who became the first caliph upon the death of Muhammad in 632 AD. So his name is deliberately chosen. And they are, you know, under his religious leadership, attempting to reestablish the caliphate that was disbanded in the 1920s after World War I. This is a Sunni apocalyptic cult that has taken a little backing from the United States and gone rogue, and they are demolishing the non-Sunni communities, Christians, Yazidis, Kurds, Shia Muslims, and demolishing those communities in Iraq and Syria. And for some reason, anytime we mention this and say, you know what, this is really a threat, these guys are telling us exactly what they want to do. You remember the interviews that I conducted with Dr. Timothy Furnish. His website, MahdiWatch.org, is a must-read if you want to keep up to date on what is happening over there, who's been saying that this strain of radical Mahdism, 10 years ago he was writing this, would be a significant threat to the West. He knew it, and he's not coming at this from a liberal perspective. He is a political conservative. In fact, his email address is at the Reagan.com domain, which gives you an idea of his politics. He is a conservative, but he's been warning about this radical Mahdist mindset based on his study of Islamic eschatology and Islamic history. And 10 years ago, he was warning about this. In fact, he was teaching about it in some of our military training classes. He is a veteran, by the way. The Obama administration, when they came in, basically took a look at what he was teaching and said, thank you, your services are no longer required. We created the problem. Yes, no question about it. What do we do now? This is not the first time we've created a group that has then turned around and gone rogue and posed a threat to the security in the region and could potentially pose a threat here in the United States. We did the same thing with the Mujahideen in Afghanistan that we trained with the help of Pakistani intelligence, turned loose in Afghanistan, and after they kicked the Russians out, eventually welcomed in the Taliban, and we wound up fighting them with our soldiers, our young men and women shedding their blood to fight a group that we created. It appears the Islamic State falls into the same category. The problem is that these guys appear to be true believers in what they're telling us they want to do, which is provoke a war with the West in order to jumpstart the apocalypse, bring on the end times, welcome in the Mahdi. And frankly, I'm just a little puzzled when we point this out and say, look, this is what they're telling us that they're doing. This is in all of their public proclamations. Their official magazine is the name of the town where they believe the cataclysmic battle will take place, Dabiq in Syria. Yet, there are folks who seem offended when I post this information or talk about this, because it's just a creation of the Illuminati or the New World Order. Well, look, get your head out of the sand, okay? The fact that it was a creation of the Western intelligence agencies, the U.S., the U.K., NATO, and the Turks, does not mean that they do not want to kill you. That's the thing that boggles my mind, is that somehow the fact that this was a creation of American and Western intelligence neutralizes the threat posed by the Islamic State. That somehow they won't kill you if you say, hey, I'm in on the secret. I know that you're really, CIA. Yeah. And I admit, I was suspicious when the first reports began coming out in the major media, when the New York Times and the Telegraph in London began running stories last fall about the destruction of Christian communities in the Middle East. I thought, well, isn't that odd? Here the Islamic State declares a caliphate last June, and the American public, tired of 14 years of adventures, military adventures in the Middle East, that had drained the national budget and cost thousands upon thousands of American lives, not to mention the lives of the civilians lost in Iraq, in Pakistan, in Afghanistan. We just don't have a real desire to tell our young men and women, you know what, you're going to have to go back. And so suddenly these stories come out about the horrific things happening to the Christians, the Yazidis, the Kurds. I'll be honest, my first thought was this is a psyop. The powers that be are getting desperate. They realize that we don't want to send our troops back to the Middle East. And now, finally, after 10 years of atrocities being committed against the Christians in the Middle East, finally the media notices. I was suspicious. I figured this is intended to get the American public riled up and angry enough to demand our soldiers return and kick some ISIS butt. But that doesn't change the fact that prior to our intervention in Iraq, there were about 1.5 million Iraqi Christians. And now there may be 200,000. It doesn't change the fact that some of the oldest Christian communities in the world, the Christian communities of Syria, the Nineveh Plain, have essentially been wiped off the map by the Islamic State. It doesn't matter who created it. The question is, what do we do next? What do we do now? I have a lot of respect for those ministries that are reaching out to Muslims and witnessing to Muslims, using the Quran to show them the unique nature of Jesus. Even in the Quran, it's clear that Jesus is unique among all the figures in their scriptures because he's the only one miraculously born of a virgin. And that is a jumping off point to have a conversation about the nature of Jesus Christ and show them that he is in fact God in the flesh. But it's difficult to have that conversation with a true believer who believes with all of his being that his path to paradise is literally over your dead body and the bodies of your wife and your children. I don't know what we do. All I know is that Colonel McGinnis is addressing a topic here that needs to be addressed, and there needs to be a solution here. And while we are trying to figure out what to do, because clearly what we've done to this point really has had no effect. It was revealed this week that the Pentagon is beginning an investigation into its reports because they've been telling officials in Washington, D.C. that our air strikes, our air campaign, and the ground attacks by the Iraqi military, such as it is, have seriously degraded the capabilities of the Islamic State. And the Defense Intelligence Agency, you remember those guys who told us, don't arm al-Qaeda in Iraq because they'll become an Islamic State, are now saying that we've not degraded their capabilities at all. They've not lost any territory. Yeah, we've killed some of them. But they're still holding the territory, and they're still advancing. In fact, on Monday of this week, the Islamic State launched a surprise attack and actually got into Damascus. Damascus. You know, for all intents and purposes, the Syrian government is government in name only. Rocket exploded just outside the Syrian government television offices there. No report of injuries, but... No, there's a huge discrepancy between what our government has been told by the Pentagon and the reality on the ground. And so now the Pentagon is investigating. But it's clear that a year's worth of aerial attacks, as Colonel McGinnis said, you know, oftentimes our guys can't find targets to hit. Our F-16s flying out of Turkey are returning to base with the bombs still under their wings. That's not working. Clearly the Iraqi military is not working. Every time ISIS mounts a determined attack, it appears, they run away. So the only thing that's accomplished is that millions and millions of dollars of American military hardware, cutting-edge military hardware, state-of-the-art military hardware, winds up in the possession of the Islamic State to be used against other Shias in the area and perhaps someday against American soldiers. Meanwhile, the Kurds, the only fighting force who's putting up resistance against the Islamic State, is denied military hardware by the American government. And our allies, the Turks, in exchange for allowing us to use their airbase at Incirlik, are launching their own airstrikes against the Kurds. Add to this volatile mix that the Russians are now putting boots on the ground in Syria. Came out this week that Russia has moved an air unit to an airbase still controlled by the Assad regime near Damascus. They'll be following with Russian soldiers soon. So now we've got Russians on the ground and in the air over Syria, which just complicates things for the Turkish Air Force, the American Air Force, and the Israeli Air Force, which has launched a couple of strikes into Syria here recently. As our friend Doug Woodward pointed out, the situation there and the situation in Ukraine, where you've got Russia doing military exercises in the Baltics, the American military leading military exercises for the Ukrainians in Western Ukraine. Basically, you've got Russia and the United States and NATO posturing in close proximity to one another, where an accident could become the trigger for an actual shooting match. Russia, of course, doesn't want things to spread any further. They've got their own problems with Islamic militants. The Caucasus Mountains, Chechnya, which is just north. It's inside Russia, but it's just north of Georgia. And, of course, North Ossetia. And you remember that Georgia, in spite of the way it was reported here in the U.S., Georgia attacked Russia a few years back when they had that little war. Russia responded to a Georgian attack, not the way it was reported here in the U.S. But Chechen Muslims are now showing up in Ukraine and fighting alongside the Ukrainian government forces against the Russian-backed rebels. It's crazy. And this area, especially the Caucasus, is an area that includes territory that would be part of the Gog or the Magog coalition in Ezekiel 38. Oh, yeah. In that same region, by the way, just south of Georgia, you've got Armenia. And to the east of Armenia is Azerbaijan. And so between Azerbaijan and Armenia, you've got a lot of bad blood. They had a war there 20 years ago, and they're agitating for war again. And Russia has said that they will intervene if that takes place, bearing in mind that Georgia is in between that area and the Russian border. So Georgia would then have Russian forces on both sides. It's crazy. It is nuts. And it appears that things are ramping up to some sort of culmination. Are we close to the end times? 20 years ago, if I'd heard myself talking this way, I would have thought that, you know, I would have figured that future Derek must have suffered a head injury or something, because I just would not have believed that I would be looking at headlines like this and seeing the potential of a prophetic fulfillment in it. But that potential is there. So, where do we go from here? Well, I don't know. We just keep an eye on things and watch and wait. But ultimately, we know that it's in the Lord's hands, and there's really nothing more that we can do about that. Pray, prepare, and just to, you know, keep looking up, as our friend Gary Stearman would say. But boy, you know, times are getting crazy. I know that there are some skeptics out there. I'm talking about atheists, agnostics, and those who don't believe in apocalyptic eschatology, who set up this straw man that somehow people who are looking for Jesus' return are excited and thrilled and delighted to see the world going to hell in a handbasket because it means Jesus is coming back sooner. Nothing could be further from the truth. Frankly, unenlightened, let's say. Nobody wants to see people suffering, and clearly that's what's happening in the Middle East and in Africa, where you've got pockets. I mean, you know, Boko Haram has killed a couple hundred more people this week in Nigeria, and they've pledged allegiance to the Islamic State. Nobody wants to see people suffering and dying in this way. But it's what we know prophetically has been foretold. So pray, prepare, get your family ready, hold them close, and love them as best you can, because the ride is going to get even bumpier here in the months and years ahead. Coming up on A View from the Bunker, we have got a conversation with Pastor Carl Gallops. He's the author of Be Thou Prepared. That will be the program uploaded this coming Sunday. And next week, Wednesday, upload a conversation I had earlier today with L.A. Marzulli. L.A., God love him, was operating on a minimum of sleep. They had just come back from conferences where and was just sleep deprived, you know, still jet lagged. But he was up early on the West Coast so that we could talk this morning, and has a new book and a new entry in the Watchers DVD series coming out, both toward the end of September. The book called Days of Chaos, which is certainly appropriate, and the Watchers 9 title, also subtitled Days of Chaos, although he says the content will be different in the DVD than is in the book. So good 45-minute conversation with L.A., and you will hear that next Wednesday on A View from the Bunker, and our hope that within the next couple of days we can get a time confirmed with Dr. Michael S. Heiser. His new book, The Unseen Realm, was released officially this week, doing very well so far. It is a culmination of a lot of work and a lot of effort and research that he's put into it, trying to explain for lay people, without sacrificing the scholarship, the divine counsel, the nature of the unseen realm. This, to me, is one of the essentials on the reference library, right up there with the supernatural worldview. I Am Not Afraid by Reverend Robert Bennett. This goes right up there with those books as essential to understanding the nature of God's creation and our role in it relative to the powers, principalities, rulers of spiritual darkness, and those angelic forces that are still loyal to God the Father. So hopefully we can get that done and have that for you toward the middle of the month. Our Bible study continues on the Gilbert House Fellowship. We've moved from Numbers into the book of Deuteronomy now, and we have those weekly Bible studies in about one-hour segments, posted usually by mid to late morning on Sunday. Our website for the Gilbert House Fellowship is gilberthouse.org, and we also have a Facebook page for the fellowship, and we'd like you to join us there, comment, and you know, follow along. And certainly if you raise points, because we are not scholars, nor do we pretend to be, but Sharon and I sure appreciate your input into the study and a better understanding of God's Word. This coming Tuesday night on Skywatch TV, Steve Quayle returns. It is National Preparedness Month, the month of September, and he talks with Tom Horn about preparedness. You'll see that at 8:30 p.m. Central Time, Tuesday night, this coming Tuesday night, on the Christian Television Network. A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod, www.incompetech.com. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.